زمینالمی کابل.
شاهان بات Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
In response to the call of the Free Palestine movement, massive crowds gathered in the Yarmouk refugee camp near Damascus to show their confidence in the strength and determination of the resistance in Gaza, confirming that the Al-Aqsa Flood operation is a fateful battle that ignited hope in their hearts, as it brings them closer to the defeat of the Israeli occupation and their return to their homeland.
We are here to support people in the Gaza Strip and voice our unconditional support to the resistance groups. After nearly 3 months of fighting, it's clear that the Zionist regime is facing defeat. The Al-Aqsa Flood operation revealed that Israel's collapse is imminent.
The Israeli occupation politically has nothing now, military has nothing now, security has nothing, economy has nothing, and we also tell the world that October 7th is the gate for the liberation of the whole Palestine, from the river to the sea.
Participants confirmed that the excess of resistance embraces the Palestinian struggle and supports all resistance factions, including the Al-Qassam Brigades and Al-Quds Brigades. They expressed their anger at the Israeli atrocities against the people of Gaza, emphasizing their adherence to the right of return and liberating Al-Quds.
Syrians and Palestinians have shown their absolute faith in the victory of the Resistance Front and Al-Aqsa Front operation, not only as a path to liberate the occupied lands, but also as inspiration for the generations to come. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
Thousands took to the streets of Austria's capital Vienna to express solidarity with Gaza on Saturday. These demonstrations were special in the sense that they were the first street protests after a court ruling removing some restrictions on acts of solidarity with Palestine. Since October 7, police and government have been imposing strict sanctions on protests and even banned expressions of solidarity with Gaza entirely. Following a demonstration on November 5 in the city of Salzburg, charges were filed against participants who held signs showing Palestine in its pre-1947 borders. Police argued the banner constitutes a criminal offense due to incitement to hatred for denying the Israeli regime's right to exist. The tide has now turned. The court dropped the charges a few days ago, arguing they violated freedom of expression. It ruled that it is lawful to carry signs showing maps of Palestine at demonstrations. The ruling comes only days after similar verdicts in Germany, where courts in Cologne and Munster ruled that the slogans "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," "Child murderer Israel," and "Stop the genocide in Gaza" can be freely expressed in the country. German police have previously used these slogans to prohibit protests for Gaza, creating worries that the free speech is under threat.
I'm here because I feel a duty to stand against the destruction of life, the environment, and dignity, because this destruction is being done in my name. And instead of making me safer, it's making it more dangerous for me to live in the diaspora.
While their governments stand staunchly on the side of the Zionist regime of Israel, thousands of people in Austria and Germany keep marching for Palestine. Experts say these demonstrations have placed some real pressure on European governments, pushing them to distance themselves from Israeli atrocities.
The court rulings are a welcome boost for the Palestine solidarity movement in Europe, where concerns are growing over a crackdown on Palestine supporters. Following recent court decisions, it is believed the coming year will see more and more demonstrations for Gaza. Dieter Reinisch, Vienna.
Good
Iraq is marking the fourth anniversary of the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. During an event attended by high-ranking Iraqi and Iranian officials, the two commanders were prized as a role model for all generations.
Today, we stand alongside our Iranian brothers to remember our leaders, General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, whose memories are engraved in our minds. And although they are gone physically, their thoughts are still with us.
Former Iraqi Prime Minister Nour al-Maliki admired the two leaders and their role in the fight against terrorism in the region. The chief of Iraq Popular Mobilization Units, Faleh al-Fayyad, also addressed the ceremony. He said the role of General Qasem Soleimani and his companion was essential in standing against Daesh. Several Iraqi lawmakers were also present at the event. They said the two commanders' determination to fight against terrorists irritated their backers.
Today we remember the pure souls that fought against terror and defeated something that made terror supporters mad. That's why they committed such a cowardly act of killing our leaders in Iraq.
They expect that by assassinating our leaders, they will weaken our resistance, but they have failed to achieve their goals, and even after committing their cowardly act, it did nothing more than adding strength to us.
The attendees also condemned the latest attacks on anti-terror forces in Iraq and Syria, which led to the martyrdom of Sayyid Razi Mousawi. They demanded an immediate end to the U.S. military presence in Iraq. And they argued that this is the only solution to stop the continuous attacks on Iraqi forces and end violations against Iraq's sovereignty. They also expressed their solidarity with the Palestinians and condemned the Israeli war on Gaza. A huge crowd have gathered today to commemorate the fourth anniversary of the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani and Al-Hajj Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The legacy of the anti-terror icons continue to live on, inspiring people in the region to stand up for the oppressed. Muslim Salim, Baghdad.
The journalists have found themselves stalked by the indiscriminate Israeli strikes, which so far have claimed the lives of over 100 journalists working for different media agencies across the globe. Journalists believe the regime is deliberately attacking them and that they are paying the price of covering the Israeli massacres and atrocities committed day and night in Gaza and putting on display the really brutal face of the Israeli occupation. This undoubtedly has limited the chance of the Israeli propaganda machine to whitewash the murder of Palestinian children and deceive people outside the occupied territories on what is really going on.
The Israeli occupation is still practicing this genocide against the Palestinian people generally and the journalists particularly. Till this moment, the Israeli army has deliberately killed 105 journalists who were doing their job of covering the Israeli crimes. And the reason behind that is to curb the coverage of Israeli crimes. In addition to that, it destroyed 96 media agencies in Gaza.
The sufferings of the Palestinian journalists in Gaza are not limited to the Israeli attacks. They are also grappling with the disastrous humanitarian conditions they are experiencing along with their families. Many of them lost their houses to constant Israeli bombardments and joined the displaced people in Gaza, who are estimated to comprise over 80% of the region's population. All they have now are small tents created of pieces of plastic, wood, and fabric, or at best, classes in the Nurwa schools, which are supposed to be safe, but have been repeatedly targeted by Israel.
We, the Palestinian journalists, consider ourselves standing on the same front beside the resistance members on the battlefield. Our battle is to show the world the reality of Israeli massacres despite the ongoing crimes against journalists and the catastrophic humanitarian conditions in Gaza. As you see, I live here in this press van. It's really hard to fulfill your basic needs even when it comes to going to the bathroom. My family fled to the schools and they faced the same hardships.
Journalists in Gaza have to deal with many problems when trying to prepare a simple report on the situation in the Strip. Many cannot even find a chair or a desk, and hence they cannot perform journalistic tasks smoothly. Making matters worse, most of the time there is no internet in the Strip, and journalists cannot communicate with the world.
As a Palestinian journalist, similar to all my colleagues, we live in a very complicated situation. Even though we are chased by the Israeli strikes and killings, we find ourselves obliged to forget about the difficulties we face in every aspect of life due to this onslaught for the sake of reporting the truth. I assure you that every single one of the 2.3 million Palestinians here has his or her tragedy, and this includes us. Our daily life is horrific and unimaginable at all levels.
Like all the other Gazans, many Palestinian journalists in the besieged district have been killed brutally by the Israeli bombardments, and those who are still alive continue to suffer from the unlivable conditions in the region. Mat'ab Msabih, the central area of Gaza Strip.
Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has slammed Israel's assassination of senior Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps advisor Sayed Radi Mousawi in Syria. Hezbollah called it a flagrant and brazen attack and a transgression of borders. Deputy head of Hezbollah's executive council told Press TV that General Qasem Soleimani had predicted that Sayed Razi would be assassinated in the battle to liberate al-Quds.
His martyrdom was only a matter of time. He was a man who had spent his youth on sacrifice. He was always ready to offer whatever assistance was needed to the resistance groups. This assassination will not stop the path which Sayed Radi al-Mousawi has opened for us. It will not stop us and other resistance groups in the region from continuing to walk in this path. We will remain on the battlefield to face this enemy which is occupying and looting our land. And with the blessing of the martyrs, the future will witness a new victory for the resistance in Gaza and the region.
Palestinian resistance factions Hamas and Islamic Jihad also said in a statement that the assassination of Brigadier General Radi Mousawi on Syrian territory is a crime and a cowardly act that threatens security and stability in the region. The Palestinian resistance groups lauded Sayed Radi for his role in supporting the resistance in Palestine.
We know that he was very close to General Qasem Soleimani and therefore worked closely with the Palestinian resistance groups and all resistance groups in the region. His efforts were based on the same school of thought as General Soleimani, and he walked in the same path which they had opened together. Today, we can see the result of these efforts in Gaza and the West Bank.
The Iranian cultural advisor in Beirut said General Mousawi was considered as a man who devoted his life to the Palestinian cause and finally sacrificed it for the sake of al-Quds.
Sayed Radi Mousawi, God bless his soul, was one of the great leaders in the IRGC who devoted his life to support the honorable resistance in the region, especially in Lebanon and Palestine. Therefore, he is a part of every blessed bullet or rocket that is being fired to target the criminal Zionist regime, whether in Palestine or Lebanon.
Sayed Radi is now seen as a regional leader and martyr, just as General Soleimani. He is regarded by many as a martyr in the long battle for the liberation of al-Quds. On the martyrdom anniversary of General Qasem Soleimani, the resistance front has bid farewell to another leader. Sayed Radi Mousawi's role in supporting the resistance groups of Lebanon and Palestine was significant. However, for the resistance, martyrdom is another form of divine victory. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has vowed to take tough revenge on Israel for assassinating a senior Iranian military advisor in Syria. IRGC spokesman Ramazan Sharif made this statement during a press conference held in the Iranian capital, Tehran. He blasted the Monday Israeli missile attack on Damascus that targeted Brigadier General Sayed Razi Mousavi's residence in the Sayed Zainab neighborhood. He also described the assassination as a continuation of Israel's violation of international laws, calling on the international community to stop the crimes of the occupying regime, which endanger international peace and security. When asked about Tel Aviv's motive for committing this heinous crime, Sharif said the regime is seeking to expand its genocidal onslaught on Gaza to the entire West Asia region.
One of the reasons is that the Israeli regime wants to extend the scope of the war beyond the borders of Palestine, and they want to deflect public attention from the Gaza war. The second point, which is important, is that the Israelis try to show off their aerial dominance. Maybe these are the two main reasons because of which the assassination was committed.
The IRGC spokesman warned that Israel must wait for a direct or indirect response as Iran reserves the right to counter the Israeli assassination. He added, the martyrdom of the Iranian commander will usher in a new era where the Zionist regime will be the loser. Sharif also touched upon the U.S. support for Israel, saying Washington is violating international law by funding and backing the regime's crimes in Gaza.
Definitely, one of their strategies has been to change the Israel-Palestine conflict to Iran-America conflict. But as the wise leader of the Islamic Revolution said on the first day of the Al-Aqsa flood operation, this operation was launched by Palestinians against Israelis, and the U.S. support for Israel is the reason why the regime continues to exist.
Brigadier General Sayed Razi Mousavi was martyred by Israel while on an advisory mission in Syria.
Truth never dies, and today it's livelier than ever as the world is observing the Israeli crimes with open eyes, conscious minds, and bleeding hearts. No matter what the Israeli regime and its supporters do to divert the global community's attention from its aggression on Gaza, the whole world are unanimously calling for justice for Palestinians. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Syrian military, religious parliamentary and popular delegations, along with resistance representatives, visited the Iranian embassy in Damascus to convey their condolences for the martyrdom of Brigadier General Sayed Razi Mousavi, the top commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The attendees condemned the heinous crime committed by the Israeli regime and expressed unwavering faith in the victory of the resistance.
This is a criminal act and an evidence of bankruptcy. When they failed in confronting the resistance, they resorted to assassinations. It is well known that their agenda is to target resistance leaders in Gaza, but they have failed so far. They have been unable to achieve any meaningful results except for killing innocent civilians.
I express my condolences and congratulations on behalf of the Syrian president for the martyrdom of Sayed Razi. The price of victory and resistance are these martyrs who join thousands of martyrs of the Syrian army and all resistance forces in Lebanon and Iraq. This is the fruit of the struggle and real work to restore our usurped rights.
In a heartfelt tribute, participants spoke highly of Commander Mousavi and his significant role as an official of logistical support for the resistance front, while resistance leaders confirmed that his blood will not be in vain. Rather, it will inspire the peoples of the region to resist more than ever until the Israeli regime is fully defeated, along with its United States supporter.
As for us, the Islamic resistance in Iraq, by the permission of God, we will have a response. Our military operations in support of Gaza are ongoing. The assassination of the martyr commander Razi Mousavi aimed to cut off the supply chains and hinder the great achievements made by the Axis of Resistance in supporting Gaza.
One of the pillars of the Axis of Resistance, who dedicated his life to serving people and defending their rights. He left a great impact on the souls of those who knew him. Participants remembered him as a generous, humble, and kind-hearted man. With profound grief and resolute determination to seek justice, they expressed their unwavering confidence that Iran would retaliate against the Israeli vicious crime. Syrians and Iranians share the same grief today, along with all fighters of the resistance front, as martyr Sayed Razi Mousavi was not only a military advisor who defended Syria, but also an icon of humanity and heroism. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
In the limelight. According to a new Commonwealth Fund survey, more than half of working-age American adults struggled to afford health care this year. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. A new survey brief by the Commonwealth Fund revealed high-income Americans are almost as likely to defer health care because of cost as people with low or average incomes in 8 other developed countries. The survey findings also show that nearly half of American adults, or 46% of American adults, faced a problem with a medical bill in the last year, and almost half with low or average income, 46%, skipped or delayed needed health care because of price, the highest rate in any of 9 countries analyzed. Munira Gunja, the lead author of the study and senior researcher at the Commonwealth Fund, said, "In some cases, lower-income people in other countries are better off than higher-income Americans, though both lower-income and higher-income adults both really struggle to use their health care." The findings come from the Commonwealth Fund, a non-profit organization that has produced several frequently cited comparative international health analyses and are part of the group's 2023 International Health Policy Survey. The result comes as the U.S. Federal Reserve and central banks around the world are battling post-pandemic inflation. Inflation slowed to 3.2% in October of 2023, but that is unlikely to give Americans much breathing room on health expenses. The cost of health care typically outpaces inflation and since 1980s has consumed an ever-increasing share of the gross domestic product, or GDP. The Commonwealth Fund asked a long list of questions about health care and income for the survey, which typically has a different focus each year. This year, surveyors focused on the general adult population 18 and older in each country. Notably, because of data privacy restrictions in Sweden, only 9 countries made it into the final analysis. The report is the first of several survey briefs. The United States fared poorly on accessibility metrics in general, but perhaps most surprising is how even high-income Americans are disadvantaged by healthcare prices relative to other nations. Almost 1/3 of high-income Americans, or 29%, said they skipped or delayed healthcare, such as filling a prescription or undergoing a test, because of a cost-related problem over the last year. That was roughly comparable to the number of high-income earners in Australia who postponed healthcare due to cost, 25%, but far worse than the accessibility problems faced by high-income earners in France and the Netherlands, where just 6% skipped or delayed healthcare. Framed another way, high-income Americans were almost as likely to delay or skip healthcare as low- and average-income people in New Zealand, 34%, and Australia, 33%. More likely to postpone healthcare than low- and average-income people in Switzerland, 28%, and Canada, 24%. And far more likely to put off healthcare than people in France, Germany, the Netherlands, and the United Kingdom, all at 16%. What's more, while all nations surveyed had disparities in health access between income levels, those disparities were most pronounced in the United States, with low- and average-income people the most likely to skip or delay health care of people in any nation surveyed. The United States is also the only nation surveyed without guaranteed universal health coverage for every citizen. In other words, everyone in the other countries is insured. About 8% of the American public lack health insurance, leaving them vulnerable to ruinous medical bills. Notably, the current uninsured rate in the United States, the worst in the developed world, is at a historic low. Munira Gunja, one of the authors of the report, said, "Having coverage is not enough. Even if you have health insurance, you may be terrified to actually use it. You may be terrified of going to the doctor and ending up with a medical bill you never expected in the mail." Decades of research shows the U.S. healthcare system is both wildly expensive and inefficient. According to the late Princeton University health economist Uwe Reinhardt, internationally it has been seen as a kind of bogeyman and as a way not to structure a healthcare system. A staggering 18% of U.S. gross domestic product goes to healthcare spending, the highest in the world, and a logical result of the highest healthcare prices of any nation. By comparison, a separate 2022 analysis by the Commonwealth Fund showed 13 developed economies spent between 8.8%, that is Korea, and 12.8%, that is Germany, on healthcare. Despite runaway spending, Americans also have among the worst outcomes in healthcare. Recent work by population researchers at Virginia Commonwealth University found U.S. life expectancy has slipped for decades and now ranks 46th in the world. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to a new Commonwealth Fund survey, more than half of working-age American adults struggled to afford health care sometime this year. While the Commonwealth Fund, a private foundation that supports health care research, found that uninsured Americans struggled to pay for health care the most, even those with employee-sponsored insurance are having a tough time affording health care. Out of the insured, 43% of Americans with employee-sponsored health insurance struggled to afford health care this year. Meanwhile, 57% of those who purchased insurance on their own, such as on Affordable Care Act marketplaces, found it difficult to pay for health care this year. On top of that, 45% of Americans with Medicaid health insurance struggled to afford health care, as well as 51% of older Americans with Medicare. Sarah Collins, the Commonwealth Fund's Vice President for Healthcare Coverage and Tracking and lead author of the study, said, "While having health insurance is always better than not having it, the survey findings challenge the assumption that health insurance in the United States buys everyone affordable access to healthcare. And the high cost of healthcare is forcing many Americans to forgo medical care. According to the survey, almost 40% of working-age adults in the United States reported skipping needed medical care or prescription drugs over the last year because they couldn't afford it. And according to the survey, almost 60% of those Americans who skipped or delayed health care because of costs said their health worsened as a result. Uninsured Americans were the most likely to put off addressing their health, with 64% reporting they skipped or delayed needed health care or a prescription drug in the last year. But 29% of working-age adults with employee-sponsored health care coverage admitted to skipping or delaying needed health care or a prescription drug this year. Out of Americans who purchased their own insurance, 37% said they skipped or delayed health care, while 39% of Medicaid health insurance holders and 42% of Medicare recipients said the same. The survey also found almost a third of working-age Americans said they had medical or dental debt because of the high cost of health care, and 39% of people with medical or dental debt said it forced them to cut back on basic needs, needs like food, heat, and rent.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
This Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, as 2023 comes to an end, this year will be forever remembered as the one which exposed the absolute hypocrisy of the rules-based system and all the organizations created under its umbrella. From women's rights to children's rights to free speech, all of these rights that many thought existed in the world, we've seen that they are null and void. When it comes to the collective West regarding the East and global South, this is especially true as we enter a new year and the Zionist genocide continues to take place against Palestinians almost 3 months after it started and is being met by collective silence and our inaction from the West to stop it. We're going to take a look at these last 2.5 months on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Richard Falk, former UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine Human Rights out of Santa Barbara, California. And Shabir Rizvi, political analyst out of London.
Is the Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to the Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with us. I'd like to start this off with Richard Falk. Well, you are a former UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine human rights. Did you ever think that you would be witnessing what you have been these last 2.5 months? This type of genocide and basically nothing being done to stop it.
My darkest form of imagination could not reach the horror show that we've been witnessing for almost 3 months, as you say. It's the most transparent spectacle of genocide that the people of the world have ever been exposed to. And the complicity of the global West, particularly the US and UK, shocks even a critic like myself, because it exposes not only the hypocrisy of the rules-based world, which was always very suspect. It was geopolitical rules for the powerful and some kind of accountability to international law for the weak. And now it has become something that is indulgent of genocide when it's committed by friends and critical of human rights of any sort if they are attributable to adversaries or enemies. So we're at a very dark place in human history, I fear.
Yes, indeed. Well, Shabir, I mean, Can you believe that you're still witnessing this genocide that started on October 7th, and we're about to start a new year, and it still hasn't stopped?
Hello, good evening. Thanks for the invitation. Firstly, condolences to the families of the martyrs, and also our sort of heartfelt pain for those who are suffering the amputations and all kinds of other bloodletting which is being inflicted on the Palestinians, both in Gaza and the West Bank, as I keep pointing out, that it's not just in Gaza that is taking place. Obviously, the numbers are horrendous. But as our friend from the USA said, we are at a dark place. Not only at a dark place, but just to quote William Shakespeare, when he said, "I'm sick when I do look at thee." He was really talking, Demetrius was speaking to Helena in a Midsummer's Night dream at that time. So it's really the, you know, we feel the sickness when we look at our politicians, our media pundit in the legacy media in the West, and also all the chattering classes, that they really have not only abandoned, but actually the the words that they used to use of human rights and of sort of freedom of speech and all kinds of flowery words, the veil has been removed, or veils have been removed from them very clearly. And I think people in the South and the East part of the world are realizing that these were not just hypocritical words, but they were words to hoodwink us into thinking that the West has some moral and ethical thinking behind it. But the reality is that now that we are seeing this happening on a daily basis, minute by minute, hour by hour, people are realizing that how inhuman the politicians are. They really have no heart at all, thinking about it. You know, people keep on talking about that Israel has a right to defend itself. Yes, Israel has a right to kill babies. Israel has a right to murder over 100 journalists. Israel has a right to kill, 22,000 people. Israel has a right to kill pregnant mothers. Israel has a right to do all the heinous crimes that one could list, and the list would be very long. But the reality is that Israel is being allowed to get away. But I think they are only going to get away for a limited period of time. I think come 2024, the support that the Palestinians are getting globally from the ordinary people, not from the politicians or the elite or the chattering classes, as I said, but really the ordinary people, are feeling that this cannot go on in the manner that it is. And again, the whole sort of hysterical Hezbollah, which is now being proven to be completely false and lies upon lies, that again, that veil which has been sort of given to the world for the last 75 years has come off in the last, less than 75 days. So people are realizing that it is just Zionism is equal racism. Zionism is equal colonialism. Zionism is equal to imperialism. Zionism is really the, the problem in West Asia. It's not the Palestinians. Palestinians are the indigenous people of that land. And again, it's not a Jewish or Muslim sort of war. It really is a war against an occupier, an usurper, and a nation which is built on people who are not part of that land.
Okay.
And this is because
stay with me, Shabir. Stay with me, Shabir. Let me get Richard back in on this. Well, Richard, how did we get here? Or were we always here, just that we can see clearer the reality? Because if we look at the rules-based system that was set up after World War II, and we see the veto power that the UN Security Council members have always had, were we always here, but there was enough of the facade in place that people didn't understand it? Or what's your assessment of this, this difference between we see reactions, what happened, for example, when Russia invaded Ukraine, as opposed to the reaction towards the Zionist regime and what this genocide they're committing against the Palestinians?
Well, you're posing a really important series of questions, and there's no simple answer. I think in one sense, the logic of the Zionist project always had an end game that is very destructive of the Palestinian people. It wanted a Jewish supremacy state that corresponded with a vision of biblical times, a kind of mythic promised land, and in a post-colonial era, to try to dispossess the indigenous people is really itself a major crime. And Israel has recently, with justification, been called the last settler colonial undertaking. So that's the background. And then in the foreground is the capture of the Zionist project by the most extremist elements in it, which couldn't complete the project without this kind of genocidal onslaught. And there's every reason to suspect that the Hamas attack of October 7th was allowed to happen and even facilitated in its execution by the non-arrival of the Israeli forces. The settler mentality that has captured the Zionist movement and has made its way to the pinnacles of power in Israel was seeking a pretext for what one might call a second Nakba, a second wave of dispossession and creating a final phase in the Israeli effort to take over the West Bank, which is the primary goal, and to perhaps reoccupy or at least depopulate Gaza. It now has some importance economically and strategically in relation to the Suez Canal, in relation to the offshore oil and gas. So there are economic reasons, and settlers on the West Bank are really real estate operators are promising coastline villas to Jewish resettlers in a new wave of settlement. So we don't know how the outcome will be phased. And then the hardest question, and the most important one in a sense, is the explanation of the complicity crimes committed by the Western countries. I think the whole relationship to the region was changed by two events. One was the Iranian Revolution in 78-79, and the second was the 1967 war, in which Israel, for the first time, emerged not as a strategic burden, which it had been in relation to the oil producers and to the Islamic world generally, but suddenly it became a strategic asset. And with Iran, the prior allied special friend under the Shah's rule, no longer present there, it joined these forces of support that had built up after the Holocaust for a Jewish sanctuary, a kind of liberal guilt in the West.
Okay.
I just want to say this one sentence, because it fused that liberal guilt with strategic military interests in the region.
Hmm.
And created a new kind of commitment by the U.S. To Israel and going along with whatever Israel did, even to this extent.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Shabir, when we look at what has happened since October 7th and the increase in pro-Palestinian activism in these Western countries and a greater awareness of Israeli crimes, and not only awareness of Israeli crimes, but the complicity of their own country's involvement, your assessment of where this will possibly go in 2024?
That's a very interesting question, because obviously, as we have been observing since day one, if you like, after 7th of October, there have been huge demonstrations in major European cities and in North America, Australia, and New Zealand. So it's becoming very clear that the ordinary masses are not in tune with the ruling elite in the respective countries. So there's a huge, if you like, a democratic gap that has been created. Secondly, what is happening is that as I said earlier, the effective, the hysterical Hezbollah was for the last 75 years letting people know that, Israel is sort of a land for the Jews because they were persecuted in Europe. And really, I find it quite extraordinary that if they were persecuted in Europe, perhaps a piece of land should have been found for them in Europe rather than in West Asia, which wasn't theirs to give. And, the former Zionist ambassador to the UN holding the Bible, saying that this is our title deed to the land. And also, Hanna Ashrafi famously said that, she didn't know that God was a real estate salesman. So the reality is that, they feel that when God needs to be brought into the conversation, then they will say that, they're God's so chosen people and this land belongs to them. However, most of the Zionists are not believers in God. The founders of the Zionist entity did not believe in God. famously the Christmas sort of sermon, which was presented by Pastor Ishaq, really quite eloquently put it that the Bible has been weaponized. So all these things that have happened were really clouding the vision of the ordinary people over the last 75 years. But it has become very clear that these were all lies which were put forward by the spokespersons from the Zionist entity and their supporters in the media and the politicians giving diplomatic and political cover to the Zionist entity. So all this has really been undone. And there was an article in the Jerusalem Post not long ago, which was really saying that, you know, we worked hard for the last 75 years to tell the people one story, but within 75 days, the world is not believing what we were telling them.
Okay.
So this is quite an important aspect, which I think is a great remorse for the Zionist entity and their supporters.
Right, indeed. Well, Richard Falk, do you think the year 2024 will be one where the whole rules-based system will continue to be exposed and even start to disintegrate?
Well, I think it started to disintegrate before. It started with the new initiatives taken in the Global South, such as the formation of the BRICS, the rise of China, the effort of the U.S. to maintain the geopolitical dominance it had in the aftermath of the Cold War, the implosion of the Soviet Union. I think that all those factors were underway. It was a process of challenging this post-Cold War world that was underway. But now, with the events in the Middle East, that challenge is going to be intensified in 2024, and the outcome is not, of course, clear. The U.S. relies only these days not on rule-based principles, but on its supposed military superiority. And that's proved a disaster through ever since Vietnam, in Afghanistan, Yemen, Iraq, several other places. So we're facing a very critical moment, and I fear that in 2024, if Israel gets backed into a corner and can't find its way out of this Gaza trap that it's made for itself, it will try to expand the war and draw these geopolitical actors into a much larger framework of conflict.
Okay. 30 seconds, Shabir. I'm so sorry, Richard. I got to give 30 seconds to Shabir. Shabir, where do you see this going as far as the Palestinian resistance? We have seen how successful they have been overall in